I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food on December 24th, 2013. That would make it Christmas Eve, wouldn't it? La 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 la. And we're going to be talking a lot about peas on earth. I didn't say peace on earth, although it is linked to peace on earth. I'm talking about peas. Peas and all kinds of other things that grow into the food that we eat. Seeds, so important. And as many people around this country today are running around for their last-minute gifts, I think we really need to be concentrating on some very simple things that make life meaningful and possible. And that's our food. And we talk about a lot of things on this show called It's All About Food, but let's just get down to the simplest form of food, which is seeds. And I'm going to bring on my first guest, Janice Ray, who wrote The Seed Underground. She's a writer, naturalist, and activist, and author of 5 books of literary nonfiction and a collection of nature poetry. She holds an MFA from the University of Montana, and in 2007 was awarded an honorary doctorate from University College in Maine. She's on the faculty of Chatham University's low residency MFA program and is a Woodrow Wilson Visiting Fellow. She will be teaching spring 2014 at the University of Montana as the William Kittredge Distinguished Visiting Writer. Welcome, Janice.
Hey there. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you.
Happy holiday.
Thank you. Fa la 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 la.
Bring on the eggnog.
That's right. Now, of course, for me, it's going to be silk nog because I'm a vegan. But anything with a little nutmeg and creamy, fatty something sounds good. And splashed with a little, what do they put in there to make it? What's the alcohol that goes into eggnog?
It doesn't really matter, but it could be brandy, whiskey.
There you go. Yeah, I'm ready.
There you go.
You know, I don't get too much wrapped up into these holidays, but somehow just with the energy that's going around, all of a sudden my schedule became very crazy hectic.
Oh, I bet.
But now we're going to sit back and relax and talk to you about this wonderful book that you wrote last year, and I finally caught up to reading it. So important and very inspiring.
Thank you.
Very inspiring. And obviously you're a poet, and the poetry goes throughout in the language of the book. I think a lot of people, I was talking to a farmer last week, I think, and his writing, although he wasn't considered a poet, his writing had a lot of poetry in it too, and I think when we're connected to nature, that poetry is just naturally there.
Do you remember that farmer's name, by chance?
Yeah, it was Ben Falk.
Oh, okay.
Do you know of him?
No, I don't.
Yeah, so he's up in Vermont, I think, and I'm just going to check my website and remember the name of his book, because what he's done, and you'd be interested in this. I think everybody should be interested in this. He basically took some really crummy land and turned it around and made a very nice plot of performing. It's permaculture, what he's doing, mm-hmm. actually. And it was 2 weeks ago. Yeah, he wrote The Resilient Farm and Homestead.
Oh, yeah. I haven't read it yet, but I've heard about it.
Yeah, it's a very nice book. I enjoyed it. And what I got in the beginning of your book and what I'm trying to do is really focus on people who are doing good things, positive things, things that absolutely need to happen, and focus on the joyfulness of that, because there's so much crap going around.
That's exactly why I wrote the book.
Yeah.
You know, I've been a nature writer for a lot of years now. And that territory necessarily comes with a lot of grief. You know, we're losing a lot of things.
So much grief.
And I decided I just couldn't do it anymore. I had to focus, and so that's why. I mean, the book is called the subtitle, A Growing Revolution to Save Food, and I just wanted to focus on the people who are in their little corners of the world doing these amazing things to preserve agrodiversity.
You know, these stories are so lovely and so interesting, and why aren't the major news media telling these stories? They're so beautiful. They're so inspiring. I just sit and read them, and I smile. People love to hear these things.
Yeah, that is a question I can't answer. I remember once there was a magazine called Hope, which was just focusing on positive news. Mm-hmm. And there's something, though, about us that wants to see danger coming. And so
yeah.
I think a kind of a pall has come over the country where we focus so much on, you know, the school shootings and climate change. And you know, there's a lot of impending disaster. There's no way. The other day, listening to the radio, I heard this phrase. This person said, I believe our society is in free fall. I mean, that's a terrifying thought.
Mm-hmm.
And if you focus on that, you know, you can't be smiling at your neighbors while you pick up your kids from school. You got to be fortifying yourself.
Yes. So we're going to go back and forth during this time period and talking about the good things and talking about some of the not so good things because they're just so out there. But just growing any seed is an incredible experience.
Yeah.
Children in school, and they have those little projects where they put their seeds in their milk cartons with the dirt and they watch it grow. It's just a delight because there's something intuitively in us that knows that growing is good.
Well, it's just such a miracle.
It is a miracle.
You have this little package of genetic material and add warmth and light and some water and an entire tree will grow. Everything that huge biomass needs for its entire future is sealed in this tiny little vault of a thing. We had a winter solstice party the other night, and a neighbor brought me a tiny little vial. His vial was, you know, like 3/4 inch tall. And he said, I thought you'd like these amaranth seeds. And inside, these seeds weren't even as big as poppy seeds.
Mm.
And he'd grown this amaranth. The other name for it is red spinach, which I've never grown. And painstakingly shelled out these little seeds. It was just such a lovely thing. And my neighbor, another neighbor, had been at my house the other day, and he saw these cashaws that I grow, a gold-striped cashaw. My grandmother used to grow them. And this man is in his 80s, and he says, I've been looking for these seeds for years. So when they had their neighborhood get-together, I took him a little vial of cashaw seeds. So there we go, spreading genetic material around. Reciprocity.
Can you get arrested for that?
I think if it was GMO, you could.
Spreading genetic material around, yeah. So can you just give us a brief summary of your book, The Seed Underground?
Yes. I started worrying about seeds. I have been a seed saver for a very long time, but my professional work has always been in saving wildness. I believe that we live on this continuum that's moved from sort of hunter-gatherer society through agrarianism into industrialism and now into whatever we're in.
What are we in?
technologism or some postmodern something. And so hunter-gatherer is represented by a wilderness, a wilderness. Agrarians by a field. And I've always been, you know, my work is centered on this wilderness. But in truth, I'm most comfortable in a field, or maybe at the edge of the field, between, you know, the woods and the growing things. I'm 51, so I knew in my early 20s the plight that seeds were in, that we were losing old varieties. And I have long been growing open pollinated seeds. Those are the ones you can save the seeds from, and saving them and growing them year after year. But I finally decided to write a book about it. I wanted to enter this conversation about genetic modification and hybridization and sustainable agriculture. I could talk on and on, Karen, so
yes.
I'll just stop there and you take
I'm
off.
I'm just thinking, you know, we live in this high-tech world, and one of the things that I enjoy in technology is a lot of open-source software. that people can use freely. And what's amazing about it is all these different people from all over the place just keep improving on it and using it. And some corporations have ended up incorporating some of these programs into their programs. But when you say open pollination, I think of open source. And I just like the whole concept of things being open. Certainly our food should be free to the food should be free. Healthcare should be free. Food should be free in this amazing society that we live in. And why should we concern ourselves with food? We should all have nutritious food to eat. It should be easy.
Well, I agree, but we all should be working toward that as well. I think that. But there are some things that I think are even more obvious. Fire, you know, water. How can we be buying springs, for example?
Oh,
water
please.
Is all coming from these great reservoirs underground. It doesn't make sense. So the theoretical term here is the commons, and I, too, think that seeds, I think genes definitely are part of the great commons, but seeds are as well.
I'm very involved in musical theater and Broadway, and you may be familiar with a show that came out a while ago. It was called Urinetown, and the concept of the show was people had to pay to pee. And it was a bit of a comedy, but not such a far stretch, because the society we live in, there's just a few that are looking to make as much money on all of us for everything. If they could charge for the air we breathe, they would. If they could charge, and they are, for the water we drink, they would. And the focus of your book is the seeds that are so necessary to grow our food, and we are losing control of our seeds. Monsanto and DuPont and Syngenta, mostly Monsanto, I think, have bought up all of the seed companies, and we've lost so much diversity in the food that's available. But there's wonderful hope, because there's people like you and other people who have saved certain seeds, sharing them. It's just such a delight to hear about.
The first group I heard doing it was the Seed Savers Exchange, and this would have been the late 70s, early 80s. Kent and Diane Whaley started this group. They had gone to Iowa, to take care of Diane's grandfather, who was ill, trying to get this story straight. And when he had given them a couple of kinds of things that he had brought with him when he immigrated to the United States. One was that beautiful Morning Glory. Oh, my gosh. Grandpa Ott's Morning Glory. And so that they realized with that gift from Grandpa Ott that those seeds would just die out with him if somebody didn't do something. So they began this movement. They created a cadre of plants people and gardeners and farmers who were stalking the countryside looking for kinds of seeds. Now, so some people were of the mindset that I was of, which was alternative, you know, marginal, always progressive, a world changer. And then some people, like, you know, let's just say I live in a very conservative area, so maybe some of my neighbors, they're keeping an old cantaloupe alive that's been in their family for, you know, five generations. So the movement crosses boundaries, because we all have this thing in common that we love food. We love good food. The more nutritious the food, the better. Our culture is basically centered in large part around food, the growing of it, the cooking of it, and so forth. So it goes beyond this movement to save diversity because of the multinationals. It's really this thing to save taste and to save memories.
I want to be clear about something, because I don't know that it's clear to everyone. Most seeds, if just left alone, don't last forever, or they're not vital forever. They don't last for a long time so that you can plant them at any time. And it, in some ways, it's the beauty about them that we need to care for them. We need to plant them so that they can grow into their fruit, and then new seeds are there. And as long as we keep planting those seeds and growing the plant and taking the fruit and replanting the seeds, this cycle over and over, then we will always have the gift of seed.
I know. They are a bit of a burden in that regard. You know, it's like it's a pet. You have to take care of the thing.
You have to take care. If you take care of them and they take care of us.
That's exactly right. Your comment brought up another point I want to make, and that is that Norway and other countries built Svalbard, which we call the Doomsday Vault, which is this place. And, you know, basically in the Arctic, above, right at, in the boundary of Norway, where countries all over the world have been sending packets of seed. And it's this place where the vault is supposed to be out of the way, in the worst case scenario of climate change and seas rising. It won't be inundated. It's fortified with, like, you know, rock walls and then concrete on the inside of that. But the best way to protect seeds is exactly what you're talking about, in living gene banks. And that's a term from Gary Nabhan, the great the MacArthur genius, who has written many books about seeds and started Native Seed Search. Living gene banks. And that's because out in the world, responding to climatic data in the moment, plants will evolve and change to fit our really rapidly changing world.
Okay.
Or at least we hope they will.
Now, there's all this conversation, not enough in my mind, but there's all this conversation about genetically modified food and hybridization. Hybridization and industrial hybridization and genetically modified organisms. And these three things are not the same.
Mm-hmm.
People get confused by them. And
you want to run through them, Karen?
Yeah, let's run through them.
Okay, these will be little definitions. So I think the first thing we should start with would be hybridization. And hybridization is not a bad thing. It's brought us this amazing cornucopia of foodstuffs that we have. So we have a Swiss chard that has green stems, Swiss chard called rhubarb chard with red stems, on and on and on. And some of this diversity, lovely diversity, is just the product of simple hybridization.
One plant having sex with another plant.
And they're two different kinds of plants.
They're mixing integrative plant sex.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So you might have a red cherry tomato and a yellow tomato and cross them and get a yellow cherry tomato. I mean, that's just a very simplified version, and it's usually not nowhere near that simple. But so that's one thing, and we'll tip our hats to plain old wonderful hybridization. But what happened is that we realized in the 20s and 30s that we could breed plants and then create something very new, you know, some watermelon that was shippable, and then a tomato that was resistant to fusarium wilt.
Mm-hmm.
So those seeds were mainly bred in laboratories and were owned by corporations. And the first hybrid seeds were introduced in 1932. I think I'm remembering that correctly. So in this case, I think I'll go one step further and say, you know, I don't have anything really against these hybrids, except that I believe that seeds should be in the public commons. Now, what was the third term? The third term was genetic modification, right?
Yes, yes.
And that simply is even sped up plant breeding, in which we are corporate multinationals and a few in general who own this technology are shooting genes from another entire kingdom of life sometimes into plant tissue in order to create sometimes very crazy seed creations. Soybeans that are resistant to Roundup spray, created by the company that sells the Roundup, so that you can, you know, in the past you would have planted, let's just say you would have mechanically harrowed your field, or if you were a chemical sprayer, you would have sprayed Roundup on your field. Then you would have planted the soybeans, and you wouldn't have been able to spray anymore, because had you sprayed an herbicide for weeds, you would have killed the soybeans you just planted. But with Roundup Ready soybeans, which is their name, they're basically wearing a raincoat that protects them from this herbicide, and you can spray indefinitely.
And so put all that poison into the earth and get into the water system and...
Yeah.
Let's go back to hybridization for a minute. So they're speeding up this in the industrial hybridization. They're just speeding up a process of putting the pollen from one plant onto another so that it kind of fertilizes one seed. And if the plants are up for it, then they may join together and create a new plant.
Right.
But if they're not up for it, then it won't work.
Well, you're going to get something back unless you get sterile seeds. But in general, you'll get something back. You may get the problem with hybridization, you know, us in our gardens, let's just say we let all of our squash run wild. We plant them all at the same time. They're all blooming together. And pumpkin crosses with a zucchini.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you are going to possibly get back any of the ancestral strains that were used in the breeding of either of those. So you might get back a zucchini that's dotted with orange spots but tastes like a gourd and is inedible. So it's a little more of an intricate process than just, you know, letting things run wild and see what happens.
Okay, so what I was confused about is there are some hybrid seeds that companies sell to make a certain kind of plant, and then the seeds that plant makes you can't use because there's...
Oh, exactly. Yeah,
want you to, or it won't give you the plant that you want. So I was wondering, how did they manufacture these hybrid seeds over and over to make the same plant?
Perfect question. They have basically a recipe in mind. So some scientist, a plant breeder, has already figured out that this cross and this cross make this. And so there are fields and fields around the world in which somebody, or, you know, many, many people, are going out and cross-pollinating these two things in order to make hybrid seeds.
Wow.
And most of this really doesn't take place in the United States. A lot of seeds are crossed in Israel and many other places.
Hmm.
So yes, let's just say I'm going to grow this. Let me just think of something that's hybrid that I would be growing. Let's say I'm going to grow a butternut squash that has been hybridized to do what spaghetti squash does, which is, you know, string off and string.
Mm-hmm.
And the butternut squash is orange, but it has strings. It's a hybrid. So I cook the squash and save the seeds, dry them out, save them, put them in the refrigerator for next year, plant those seeds, and I am not necessarily going to get back the same thing I planted. I could get back a spaghetti squash. I could get back a gourd. I could get back a plain old Waltham butternut squash.
Mm-hmm.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
However, if a plant breeder does his or her job and continues to grow out the plant, you can actually stabilize a line so that it does become an open source seed. Meaning, so I would plant all these seeds. I would save the seed that is most like the thing I planted, and then I would plant those seed and save the thing most like the one. Do you see? So you're working backwards, really, to get what you wanted. And by the by 7 to 10 generations, you can stabilize this line and then plant those seeds and always get back this orange-colored spaghetti squash.
Right. Or, so you're ultimately reducing the genetic material in each generation so that it always has the same traits.
Yeah, it's a process, sort of like a, it's a sort of a process in this case of selection pressure.
Ooh, selection pressure. Okay. Now, so there's all this stuff going on with different companies buying up the seeds, getting control of our food, and it's scary. What do people do that are living in cities? What should we be doing? Should we all be looking for little plots of land and growing food?
That you're asking a wonderful question, and I think it's the one question that trips people up when they think about this idea, because in some ways the minute we hear about saving seeds, we think, oh my God, I can't even grow anything, so this is beyond my control. In the back of the Seed Underground, I have a list of what you can do, and the first thing on that list is eat real food. And that is, if you are eating whole foods, you are electing for a farmer somewhere instead of instead of agribusiness to feed you. And then beyond that, learn to cook real food.
These are tall orders for a lot of people.
I know.
Eating real food and cooking their food. Ah!
Shop at a place where you know the person who grew that food. Talk to that person who's growing the food. Are these hybrid seeds? Are they open pollinated? Do you save seeds? When I eat this pumpkin, should I save the seeds for you? And beyond that, there are plenty of things you can do as a seed activist. There are villages and towns in this country that are passing resolutions, their entire states trying to pass resolutions to prohibit GMO seeds and GMO foods or to require labeling of GMO foods. It goes on and on and on.
I like how in the book you write, the logical next step for the local food movement is to establish locally grown seeds, although I think you might have been quoting somebody when you wrote that. There's a lot of scientists who will say certain seeds can only be grown in a certain location, and what I'm understanding is that seeds are so smart that some of them learn to adapt to their environment. And I'm thinking of all this technology that's going in to help other countries grow their food, make things drought tolerant or whatever. And we know that a lot of it is a lot of hype just to get control of the food supply. But seeds, with a little help, can figure this out on their own.
Within reason, Karen.
Within reason, sure.
I'm never where I am, let's just say where you are in New York, you're never going to be able to grow papayas.
No. But, I almost did, actually. I used to compost on my terrace in Queens, and I put a lot of different seeds in there, and a papaya plant grew out of my compost. I never got fruit from it, but it did start growing.
But I think the point that you're making is that over time, as we plant and save and plant and save, yes, plants do adapt to microclimates and to entire climates. So yes, you have a great point.
Well, yeah, I know there's a lot of places that have a lot of difficulty and need a lot of help in lots of different things. Adaptable seeds are not the only thing that's going to be necessary to help them. But seeds do adapt, and in this time of crazy climate change, it's going to be interesting to see how our seeds adapt to the change in the climates that the seeds are used to growing in.
Well, it brings us back to this idea of resiliency, that your guest earlier talked about. And I think seeds are a huge part of that, just making sure that we're protecting our seed supplies. keeping seeds in the commons. I think a great way to control the food supplies across the globe is to control seeds, and then not just protecting the seed supply, but also planting them and letting our foodstuffs evolve. That's probably too scientific a word for what I'm saying. Letting them adapt.
There are so many things I want to talk about. I just want to bring up one more thing because we're out of time. But you mentioned Martin Disley, a Minnesota organic farmer from Gardens of Eagan. I read his wife's book, Organic Farm Works, which was another lovely book about organic farming and all the trials and tribulations that people have to go to just to plant and grow real food.
Mm-hmm.
And this was about you said, Tracy, who's working with a field corn he's developing with Martin Diffley. Corn is a fascinating food, the fact that it doesn't look anything like what its original ancestor looked like and how it's come to be the food that it is today.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, how we've gone several levels beyond being corn, and now we have genetically modified corn that's like taking over the planet. I like to say that every food has its story, and corn certainly has its own fascinating story.
Yeah.
So what I want to say is I said it at the beginning, this is a lovely book, and for people who have not gotten their Christmas gifts yet, this would be a great little stocking stuffer or under the tree, because it's important and it's also beautiful reading. And, this book came out, you know this, Janice, but the book came out last year, 2012. And I'm just kind of curious before we go, what's happened since you wrote that book?
What's happened with me personally? With
you
the book
and
itself?
Seeds and the reaction to it and the information that people are getting.
I think what is happening is what was already happening, and that is that communities across the world are really rising up to understand seeds. And it may be a new lending library in Valdosta, Georgia, or people getting together to do more and more seed swaps. It's really an amazing movement. And so what I see in this year is definitely more interest in seeds and just more concern that we don't lose this gift of food that civilization's been given.
Okay, amen to that. Thank you, Janice, for joining me today on It's All About Food.
Thank you so much, Karen, and have a wonderful, wonderful set of holidays.
Thank you. You too. Be well. Okay. Bye. All right, I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Let's take a very quick break, and then we'll be back with Dr. Tom Campbell, who is the Executive Director of Nutrition Studies.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know, where the treetops glisten and children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow. Of a white Christmas, with every Christmas card I write, may your day be merry and bright, and may all your promises.
Everybody, we're back. I'm Karen Hartglass. It's Christmas Eve, December 24th, 2013. And I really enjoyed just listening to White Christmas just now. It took everything I had not to sing along. It was really lovely. All right, let's bring on my next guest, Dr. Tom Campbell. He is the Executive Director of the T. Colin Campbell Center for Nutrition Studies. He's also an instructor of clinical family medicine at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry, a board-certified family physician. He sees patients part-time in an active primary care practice in Rochester, New York. Welcome, Dr. Campbell, to It's All About Food.
Well, thank you for having me, Karen. I appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, thank you. I'm very excited to talk to you because I've known your father for a very long time and kind of read about you along the way. And it's kind of exciting to see the path that you've chosen to take.
Yeah, I'm excited by it. I've sort of followed a path of opportunity that presents itself whenever it pops up, following whatever seems interesting at the time, and here I am now doing something that I certainly wasn't doing 15 years ago, or didn't even think about doing 15 years ago. But it's very fascinating to me, very interesting.
Well, we're glad to have you doing what you're doing, and I'm really enjoying to see in this plant-based world, this plant-based movement, a few of the dynasties or royal communities that are kind of coming out. So we have your father, Dr. T. Colin Campbell, and yourself. We have Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn and his son, Rip Esselstyn. We have John Robbins and Ocean Robbins, Frances Lemuel LePay and her daughter, Anna LePay. And there's a few more probably that I'm leaving out. But very exciting and so, so necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you were involved with your dad in the China study.
Yes, I started working on that in about 2001. He asked if I wanted to help him write the book, and initially I was going to just do some editing, help him sort of shape his voice and his writing. And as we got into it, I took on a much larger role. I did an awful lot of library research, and I did a lot of writing myself, very intense learning experience for me, and 4 years later, we finished a manuscript of the China study, and that really sort of set me on this path that I'm on now, promoting optimal nutrition.
Now, when you were growing up and your dad was going through a lot of what we read about in the China study, did you know what was going on?
You know, I really was not terribly cognizant of his career, his successes, and exactly what he was doing. I remember sort of hearing, you know, there are things that were exciting now and then. I remember, you know, some big magazine coming to take some photos. You know, this was after he was on the National Academy of Sciences Diet and Cancer Committee, and you know, that's, I was like, oh, okay, someone taking photos. And then that was about the amount of time that I spent on it. And I think it was probably someone from, you know, People magazine or something. And I just had no idea.
Right.
And I had no idea. And furthermore, as far as food choices went, I really just was eating, you know, what was fed to me. Like most kids, I didn't put too much thought into it.
And in writing the book, did you change your diet? Or did
it
come later?
I did. I was mostly vegetarian. I was vegetarian from my adolescence. It was a slow transition, but roughly 14, 15. And then when I started writing the book, and by the time I finished the book, gosh, what was that now? 10, 11 years after becoming vegetarian, 12 years after becoming a vegetarian, I gave up the dairy food through the process of working with my dad on the China study. So as we were writing that and I became exposed to all the information, I made that decision to give up dairy food.
Okay, you were on a very different path when you went to college and then when you mm-hmm. wrote this book. In fact, I think you were studying to be an actor?
Yes, yeah, I did training in theater and acting at Cornell University, and then I pursued it professionally for a couple years. Had some jobs, none of them enough to make a living at it, but some money here and there, and mm-hmm. I was a paralegal to pay the bills. And then that's when I had this opportunity to work with my dad on the China study.
Right, and then you went to medical school and became a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Something every parent wants their child to do.
Yeah.
And we need more doctors like you. So when you were going through medical school, you already knew a great deal about nutrition. What was going on around you in terms of the knowledge of other people about nutrition and health?
Well, you know, it's unfortunate. It's been cited many times for many decades, but the amount of formal training in nutrition that gets included in medical school curriculum is very, very, very small. We had at my school, which I consider to be a good school, you know, decent school, we had just a couple of days on nutrition as part of the lectures, and it was not taught by anyone with any particular great knowledge or interest in nutrition, and focused mostly on the biochemical reactions related to protein metabolism, fat metabolism, et cetera. So there was almost nothing, for example, about how diet interacts with obesity, how diet interacts with diabetes. You know, for this sort of public health urgent issues that need to be discussed simply were not taught or discussed in my education. And I can say that, you know, that's the norm, and that's been stated as the norm for many decades now. So I went into this with open eyes. I knew what I was getting into, and I just did the best I could to learn the world of medicine. It takes basically a full-time sort of life commitment for at least 7 years to learn.
Wow.
All the all the stuff that you need to know to practice medicine, and you just put your head down and I sort of did it. But
sometimes you have to play the game in order to change the game.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Did you ever stir up any trouble while going through school?
No, I didn't. I mean, I think as a medical student, those first 4 years in medical school, you're just absolutely sort of swimming to keep your head above water and you know, learn everything you need to learn and do good on the test, do well on the tests. And then in residency, I went to the University of Rochester Family Medicine Residency Program, and they were very supportive of my interest in nutrition and my plant-based message and the China study. So I actually had the opportunity to give grand rounds at my hospital on a couple different occasions and gave lectures to my colleagues and that type of thing. So I didn't cause too much trouble because I tried to do as good a job as I could, you know, what mm-hmm. I was with the things I was tasked with. My personal opinion is you don't cause, in that situation, I wasn't going to gain much by going out there and ruffling feathers. I just had a lot of stuff to put my head down and do my work.
And you have a part-time private practice now.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. And these people, your patients, do they know that it what they're getting when they get you with a doctor?
I think they.
I mean, do they seek you out, or do you have some surprised patients? What?
A few do. So yeah, I'm with a university primary care practice, and it's a new practice that I joined. So we've only been open for, going on 6 months now, 5-6 months, and I'm not advertised as a special nutrition doctor or lifestyle doctor or anything like that. I'm just a family doc that takes care of belly pain and older adults, kids, whatever. So most of the people who come through the door do not know too much about my background or interested in nutrition. But, I talk to everybody about it. Some of them want to hear more. Some don't, as you might expect.
Yep.
It's always an interesting conversation.
So you're not at the point, I remember hearing that there were some doctors out there that wouldn't take patients who smoked that weren't trying to quit.
Yeah, no, I have no interest in doing something like that. I find that it keeps me, from a personal point of view, actually, I gain so much by working with, quote-unquote, normal people. It keeps me grounded, and it keeps me in touch with how people are living. We take all kinds of insurance, Medicaid, through Medicare, and everything
awesome.
In between. So I see the whole slice of society, and it keeps me very grounded with how people are living and how people interact with the environment to either promote health or sickness and what they know about that. And that's just incredibly valuable. It keeps that grounding in that sort of real world. So,
yeah.
I don't want to exclude people who don't follow the rules, before they walk in the door, so to speak.
That's good, and being grounded is really important. I know that when we spend a lot of time in our own community, like when I'm hanging out with all the vegans, you can lose comprehension of what's really going on outside and how people struggle with food, with diets, with their lifestyle, with children. It's very complicated and hard.
Absolutely. And it's easy to forget that most people have not heard anything about plant-based diets and the health benefits. I mean,
it's so hard to believe,
but it's true. And they have lived their entire lives with this incredibly personal, powerful set of habits, eating, choosing the food that you eat, and challenging someone to think differently is a humbling experience and very valuable to me and something I cherish.
Now let's talk about the T. Colin Campbell Center for Nutrition Studies. What's going on there?
Well, we have had a very exciting year over the past 6 months. I just started there about 6 months ago as the executive director. We got a director of education, our associate director all sort of started about 6 months ago, and we have had just a phenomenal year enrolling people, everybody from health professionals to the lay public who's interested in plant-based nutrition in our certificate program, and we offer that in partnership with eCornell. A lot of health professionals can now get professional credit for taking that certificate program from a variety of different disciplines, and we've just, the content is unique. People are excited to hear maybe something about T. Colin Campbell, or maybe they've read the China study, or maybe they read something about plant-based nutrition, and we really have a very good certificate program. So we're pushing that, and it's going very well. We also have some new courses sort of in the pipeline that we're designing and going into the studio to film and write and all this stuff, this winter. So we changed our name from T. Colin Campbell Foundation to T. Colin Campbell Center for Nutrition Studies to be a little bit more descriptive. We also made a new website. We're putting a lot of content out there on our website. It's nutritionstudies.org. And, yeah, we're just trying to get bigger, better, more audience, and, you know, cater to our audience better.
Do you think at some point there'll be like a bachelor's degree in plant-based studies?
That would be great, but not anytime in the near term. I think that, you know, online education in general has a lot of structural issues to work out before something like that happens. I mean, obviously there are degree programs out there, graduate degree programs, even undergraduate degree programs, but I think for nutrition, that's not something that we want to do or we want to offer. There's just a tremendous value, I think, you know, to the years of work that go into a traditional college experience that we're just not going to replace anytime soon. So we're really looking at supplementing a traditional education and offering something that, quite frankly, you can't find at a lot of places, you know, a point of view looking at plant-based nutrition, and not only plant-based nutrition, but asking really important questions as, like, how do we generate information, and once we get that information, how do we disseminate it to the people, to the public? You know, fundamental kind of system questions that we get a chance to address. So we're happy in our little niche, and I think we'll stay here for a bit longer.
Okay, and this plant-based certification, is this something people can do online?
Yes, it's an online program. It's all online, and they can do it, you know, at their leisure. It is offered. The details are all on our website, but it's offered in 2-week blocks, 2-week chunks. So people have 2 weeks to complete the lessons and the quizzes and so forth. And there's 3 sets of 2-week courses. So it's the 6 weeks total, about 18 hours of instruction, along with discussions and quizzes and an opportunity. We have live instructors that answer questions that provoke discussion, provoke thought, that type of thing. And so it's all online, and it's through the eCornell platform, which is a very, very nice system.
Very good. Well, more people need to be learning about plant-based nutrition. There's no question about that. And I look forward to it being a requirement in most medical professions and dietitian professions. Yeah. Okay. Now, what do you eat, Dr. Campbell?
No one is perfect. I adhere quite strictly to a whole food plant-based diet, but, I eat only plants. I'd say 99%. Occasionally, if I slip up and I have a cookie or something, whether it's all a vegan cookie or something with actual butter in it, from a nutritional point of view, it's probably junk either way. But most of what I eat is fruits, vegetables, whole grains, you know, oats for breakfast, lunch of leftovers, which is usually some sort of vegetable casserole with a whole grain, and dinner with vegetables and whole grains and salads, and always trying to get in some greens in as well. And I try to eat more greens, always trying to eat more greens.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in a green-based diet.
Right.
And you have children?
No. We don't. I'm married. Okay. No kids yet.
Okay. So you haven't dove into the challenge of feeding kids in this world, which is a big can of worms.
It is. Yeah. I don't have personal as a doctor, I counsel people, but I don't do it myself quite yet.
Well, it's definitely challenging in this world with commercials and peer pressure. It's really hard to feed kids well, but more and more people are doing it, and that's good.
Yeah, I think there's certainly, it's very important, the examples that you set and the consistency with which you, offer any sort of guidance or quote unquote rule or habit that you introduce. Consistency is very, very important. So, you know, allowing McDonald's for 1 week and then going back and having a salad every night the next week, you know, that's never going to work. you've got to be really quite consistent in the dietary message and firm, and kids will kind of learn to respect that.
So it's December 24th, Christmas Eve, but it's also the deadline for people who have enrolled in the new Obamacare healthcare market to select their plans. And do you have any feelings about this new insurance program?
You know, it's funny. I don't know that there's too many people that feel expert in the new program, and I certainly don't count myself as feeling expert in the new program.
I don't know how anyone could be one since it hasn't really taken off yet.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty uncommon. But I think that, you know, my sense of it is that the goals are my personal sense. The goals are very good. I mean, our health insurance system is deeply broken, and you know, I see people who are just absolutely scrambling, you know, bankrupt, have no money for health care, have to make tough decisions for treatment, seeing doctors, et cetera. And it's just not working for a large percentage of our population, too large a percentage. And so the goals of it to try to correct that are very good. I do have concerns that the program is in some ways, you know, taking our current system and just trying to apply it bigger and more broadly to everyone.
Yeah.
When what we really need is a healthcare system that pays and rewards and incentivizes, you know, personal preventive care, personal responsibility for preventive care, and also reimbursing preventive care and lifestyle medicine, really treating the cause. You know, I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but some great majority of our healthcare expense is chronic disease, and largely that's preventable and treatable. The exciting thing is it's now treatable if you can just treat the cause with lifestyle. But yet, if I see a patient with, you know, heart disease, I cannot get paid adequately to sit down with them for an hour, or I can't get paid to take them to the grocery store and, you know, show how to shop for food, you know, appropriately.
There's something wrong with that picture.
No, I can't get. But they could be. You know, someone else can get paid $50,000 for doing a stent or a bypass, and so we really need to turn the whole system upside down. And I don't think the legislation can do that at this point.
No, but the best health insurance we all have is choosing the right foods to lower
right.
our risk of disease, and that's
right.
the number one thing that we can all do.
Right.
Well, Dr. Campbell, thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food, and I really enjoyed hearing your story and glad you're out there doing what you're doing.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Very happy holidays to you, and say hi to your dad and your mom, Karen.
I will, and he said to say hello, actually.
Okay,
he said that
great.
Earlier, so.
Great,
yep.
Thank you. Okay.
Thanks. Bye.
All right, we just have like a minute left, and I just wanted to say happy holidays to everyone. Next week I'm going to be taking off, so I won't be able to say Happy New Year, but I'll say it now, Happy New Year. And this is a time of giving, and I do have a nonprofit, ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com, and we certainly do welcome and appreciate your support. You can visit ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com, go to our donate button, and help us do all the things that we're doing at REAL. And that's it. So very happy holidays, and have a delicious end of the year.